When Charles Foster Kane died, he said just one word.
Rosebud.
That always said, Rosebud. Tough guy, huh?
Yes, Rosebud.
Guy's calling
just
her Rosebud.
Just that one word. But who is she?
What was that?
Here's a man that could have been president, who was as loved and hated and as talked about as any man in our time. But when he comes to die, he's got something on his mind called Rosebud. Now, what does that mean?
A racehorse he bet on once.
Yeah, that didn't come in.
All right. But what was the race?
Rosebud.
Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Rosebud.
Hold this picture up a week. 2 weeks if you have to.
What do you think right after his death? It might be
find out about Rosebud. Get in touch with everybody that ever knew him. Oh, who knew him well? That manager of his, Bernstein. His second wife. She's still living.
Susan Alexander Kane.
She's running a nightclub in Atlantic City.
Yeah, that's right.
See them all. Get in touch with everybody that ever worked for him. Whoever loved him. Whoever hated his guts. I don't mean go through the city directory, of course.
I'll get on it right away, Mr. Ralston.
Good. Rosebud, dead or alive.
What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Retro Movie Podcast, the podcast where everything is connected. I'm your host, Jacob Thompson, and joining me is my co-host, friend, and the person most likely to go to Florida and build a big mansion called Xanadu, Alex Perkins. Perk, how are you doing tonight?
I'm well, thanks. Yeah, I guess if I had the means,
yeah,
I would
statues.
I would definitely come up with some rooms in a house that look like they're 10 times sized with a fireplace that could fit a bus through it and have your furniture spaced 50 feet apart.
Yeah, as if to shout at your guests.
As if to shout in casual conversation.
In the intro, like a pleasure palace or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
My God. But when they said that, I'm like, is this like a sex thing? And it's like, nah, it's just like
no.
A lot of fun stuff in there, I guess. But
just excess.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is the podcast where every Perk and I review a movie connected to the last one we watched. If you like our show, follow us on podcast services and YouTube and TikTok and all that fun stuff. But Perk, we got a big episode today, so I just want to jump right into it. Last week or 2 weeks ago, we watched Casablanca, and this week we watched Citizen Kane. Our connection being the character actor Gino Corrado, the living legend. He was a waiter at Rick's in the last movie. In this movie, he played a guy called Gino, which I think is right at the beginning when the reporter goes to see the second wife, and she's like, "Give me another drink," and the guy goes, "Gino, get another highball." I think it's that guy.
Oh, okay.
So that's our connection. But Perk, introduce Citizen Kane for us, please.
Yeah, Gino was great. Highlight of the movie. All right, yeah. Citizen Kane is a 1941 joint, directed and starring Orson Welles. It's about a man, the full life of a man named Charles Foster Kane, who starts off via humble beginnings and winds up the tycoon running a media empire. And it follows him and his relationships and his corruption by greed. This is lame to say, but there are so many interesting facts surrounding this movie. So like, please go look into it. But a few that are just kind of stuck out. This movie flopped terribly so far to the point that it was vaulted by RKO, the production company. And when it was nominated for 9 Oscars, and every time it was mentioned at the Oscars, the audience booed. I know. That's something else. This was crazy to me because I didn't notice, but the audience, when he's giving his political speech, is a still photo where the way that they fake movement is by like poking little pinholes in the film so that light comes through to like give the illusion of movement. And I'm like, I'm mad that I didn't notice that because it's
I didn't catch it either, but I've seen some of the behind the scenes of that kind of stuff before
in
movies, and it's always so cool how they were that creative to come up with these kind of like techniques. Like, it's awesome.
And then the movie is semi based on William Randolph Hearst, a media tycoon who knew about the production and was furious about it all and did some crazy stuff trying to discredit Welles, like calling him a communist and all that. But to the extent where rumoredly Welles was at one point tipped off that in his hotel room waiting for him, William Randolph Hearst had planted a naked underage woman and a photographer that when he opened the door, she was going to jump on him and they would take a picture to, you know, cancel him effectively, which is insane. But he didn't stay in his hotel that night. So maybe some truth to that. I don't know.
In as insanity.
Yeah.
But kind of tracks with the character that is, you know, Kane. But so Berg, I've never seen this before, right? First time for both of us. Obviously, this is a very well-known movie. It's heralded as being super ahead of its time.
It's often cited as like best of all time on many lists. So, I mean, my thoughts, I thought it was really good. It like divorcing it from the context, which is hard to do because there's a lot of stuff that really elevates it that you may not notice because they've just become tropes, you know, over the years, but there's a lot of things in this movie that didn't exist at the time. We take them for granted. So I think this is a really good movie. It's a very compelling story about an interesting character, but it's not like just strictly looking at the movie as it is. It's not my best of all time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of with you where I think it's really, really good. And especially viewing it within the time period, it's like insane. I think just on the whole, like, I think it's shot super, super well. I think they're really creative with the camera. Performances are fantastic. We were talking before we started recording, like, all like the old person makeup is really good and they're all good at acting old, which I don't know. I guess I just can't take that for granted. I feel like a lot of times we see actors in old makeup, it can be kind of jarring. But because it's in black and white and older, maybe it's because like the lower resolution, it's easier to buy. But I thought the acting was great. And I think the thing that struck me the most was just the complexity of Kane's character and how like emotionally complex he was and them like calling him out for it. Like when his second wife leaves him, you know, he's going on these excuses of like, oh, like I'll make things better. I'll like do what you want, not just what I want. Don't do this to me. She's like, oh, doing it to you. And she like calls him out. And like those kind of conversations I would not expect in a 1941 movie. Like those feel like very,
very, very poignant.
Like modern. Like that's stuff like my therapist would talk to me about, you know, like I was just shocked to see that kind of that they understood that character that well to have those kind of conversations about how he viewed love. And that, yeah, it just really, really impressed me. And I think for that reason, this movie really holds up. And yeah, I think the other thing I was worried about when it first started, especially when he's like young and just gets a newspaper, I'm like, oh, this is going to be like not all rich people are bad kind of a thing. But no, like he starts out with good intentions, but his money does kind of corrupt him and he uses it to try and feel love. But it's a misguided way. And yeah, there's really good stuff in here. Like, I think it does hold up to, you know, a modern lens.
Yeah, I think that. The screenplay, like the writing is just fantastic. I agree with you. I think the directing is great. There are so many just really clever shots. Like at one point the camera is just looking at like a shiny silver vase and we're looking at the reflection of someone walking through the door, which is just like thematically relevant because it's all about the stuff and the, you know, the people are more of the periphery for him. Yeah. And yeah, you're right, because he coming up, Kane is he's an idealist, right?
Yeah.
Like his whole goal is like someone needs to stick up for the people who can't stick up for themselves. And so, yeah, at the start, it's like, oh, we're going to watch him, you know, take down the baddies. And it really is a story of how, you know, greed corrupts and his character just the through line of his character is so good. And all of his motivations make sense. And you can even tie it back to like, he was taken away from his mother when he was like 8. And so, you know, he never had that familial love. He was raised by a cold analytical banker, essentially.
Yeah.
So you can see why, you know, raised in an environment of accounting and banking, he thinks that love is, you know, more transactional as opposed to like a real feeling. And he craves that connection because he lost it with his parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm waffling, but basically I think that the story is really good.
It, yeah, I know. And it, yeah. there's the one of those poignant scenes to me was when Jed, his friend, comes in drunk and he talks about unionization coming and how, you know, if Kane was a real idealist, he'd be pro-unionization, but he's like, oh, you're not going to like this because they're going to be able to get what they need for themselves. They won't have to come to you to get what they need, you know. And that was just so enlightening of like, okay, like this character, yes, he says he's an idealist and he says he wants things for people, but he wants their love and he wants it to be a transaction. Like, I do this for you, then you love me and I feel better. He doesn't full, it's not fully selfless. And yeah, the greed that corrupts him is not a greed of money, because he doesn't care about money. It's a greed of love. Because he, like you said, he didn't have that growing up. And yeah, like I said, I was shocked we're getting these types of themes in this old of a movie. For some reason, I have this like bias in my head of like old movies were simpler and like because I don't know. I assume emotions weren't talked about that much back then. Like, you know, you wouldn't have these kind of like themes. But yeah, it really worked. And I will say I was a bit jarred. I don't know what you feel this too, in the opening. Like there's a lot of exposition thrown at you right away. And you don't realize you're watching a newsreel. At least I didn't. They have like the opening stinger thing, but it was a lot to like go through really, really fast. Like, what is, and like, this is gonna be the whole movie of just like a news type thing. And then we get out of that and we get the actual story. But the beginning was a bit much for me. I was a bit overwhelmed by the amount of exposition we got right up the front.
I think that's fair. It's definitely, it's long, the news stinger. I picked up on that it was going to be like a newsreel and we were going to tie back in. And they do kind of go back and unpack everything that was,
yeah,
that was mentioned. It's kind of almost like a forward to the establishment, yeah, of the rest of the movie. And it, you know, the lens through which they attack that is, well, here, this was just events, like someone go get the punch, go, you know, right, find out, let us know what all this actually means.
Yeah, find the story.
Right. I do think, yeah, maybe it's a little long. And if you're not aware that it's like, it's going to end after 15 minutes or whatever, I could see it being, yeah, it's jarring because it's definitely long compared to what, like, more modern times you see that type of device used in like a 2 or 3 minute little blurb.
Yeah.
Rather than over the top in length. But it worked for me in just like how it kind of spread the web for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I know. I think it is ultimately helpful because, yeah, then when we popped into like a timeline later, it's like, oh, I remember this from the newsreel. I have some context already.
Yeah,
I was just like, yeah, I'm like, wait, what's going on? Like, what is this movie about? I don't, you know, the guy's named Kane. Is this his Kane or is there enough? His son is like the yeah. But once we got into it, it all made sense. But.
I also was wondering when we were watching that, it's like, okay, but what part of this vignette that we're seeing of this life, what part is the part that we're actually going to follow for the movie?
Yeah.
And the answer is all of it in a unique way for the time. So to just tie back to how this movie is like a structural trailblazer, the mechanic of the movie where they put together his life story via going and talking to people from his past, in a non-chronological fashion, just hadn't been done at the time.
Yeah.
At least not on this big of a scale. You know, there's always people experimenting on smaller mediums, but like at this time, movies go A to B and that's it. You follow your protagonist and you go A to B, and this one you don't follow your protagonist at all at the top lens, like through the metatext you do, but it's going to talk to people and do a clip in the current and then go back and do a flashback and then a clip of the current flashback. And while this is something that like we all know how this goes, because
yeah,
it happens all the time, for it to be the first is kind of crazy to even think to implement something like that at the time was insane. And I think it works really well.
Yeah, so they did it well. Yeah.
Yeah, because all the other than I will say the portion where they talk to Jed was a little bit long, and I was like, wait,
yeah,
we're seeing some things that Jed wouldn't have been in on or known about. But you know, there's always gonna be a couple holes. It's the first time doing something like this. But
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed that plot mechanic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think they nailed that. Also, just a quick interlude on the Jed, like, we already kind of mentioned, but he did a great job of acting like an old guy who wants some cigars, you know? Like,
yeah.
That was great. And then, like, even when Orson Welles is old and his second wife leaves and he is moving around the destroying ship, he's, like, kind of stiff because he's older. Like, it looks goofy, but I think it would look goofy, and it worked again. Like, I don't know. I'm just, like, so impressed by the old acting. Because I don't know if you said this, but I heard people with, like, Irishmen, it was kind of weird of, like, I guess the opposite problem of having, like, an old De Niro who is de-aged, and he still moves like an old man, and kind of people getting taken out of it. But in this case, like, they're all good at acting like crazy old people.
Yeah, to tie into that, we were talking before the show, but I didn't realize before, but this movie was made, Orson Welles was given the movie when he was 24. So he's 24 years old, and he wrote, and, well, there's context behind that, but he directed and starred in this movie at 24. And I was, like, impressed with the scenes when he's a young man. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, did they, like, de-age him for this? Because I'm assuming that he's, like, in mm-hmm. his 40s when the movie happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. Like, the scenes when he's older are so, like, you're right. The makeup is just so well done that I assumed that this was at a later stage in his life.
Mm-hmm.
No, he mm-hmm. was 23 or 24 the whole time. It's crazy to think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you. The makeup, the aging is so well done. And yeah, the way that the characters inhabit those older bodies is really seamless.
Yeah. All right, Perk, here's the big question. Was the Rosebud reveal worth it?
I think yes. I think it contributes to the message, but
yeah.
What do you think?
I think it was fine. That's the only thing I knew about this movie is the word Rosebud. I didn't know what the twist was. I knew there was, like, a twist or a reveal,
sure.
But I assume Rosebud was, like, the name of the game. So I was relieved when it's, like, the first opening of the movie. It's like, okay, it's not like a secret thing. It's like literally what the movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, it just emphasizes the theme we were talking about of, like, yeah, his childhood got taken away from him, and that kind of, you know, butterfly affected his entire life and kind of made him the person he was, which ended up being kind of shitty.
Right. Yeah. So and the Rosebud ties back to a memorable moment in his life, a traumatic moment, because that's the moment he's taken away from his parents is with that sled in hand.
Yeah.
But also on top of that, because no one was able to unpack it, it also contributes to the idea of, like, not everything is just... It could have just been something lost, mm-hmm. something he never had. And it not everything in a man's life can be tied together so simply.
Right.
Which is another statement that the POV character, Thompson, I think it was.
Yeah.
He makes that statement at some point. It's like.
Yeah, at the very end. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe you just can't boil it down like that.
Mm-hmm.
The reveal that it's the sled both. Emphasizes that, you know, it doesn't tie everything up, but it also, it's justified because that's a moment that he would be very tied to emotionally.
Yeah, because I didn't have a whole, like, oh my God, mind blown. It was just like,
yeah,
oh.
Right.
It was like, oh, that emphasizes the theme, which I appreciate. Like, I'm a big themes guy. So, I think this movie is really cool. I think it's definitely worth watching. I keep getting... My biases challenged with this series. It's like I keep thinking that these old movies that are the greatest of all time be super pretentious. It's like, no, this is just like a good movie.
Right.
And turned out to be based on somebody's life, which I did not know about before reading the trivia, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, definitely. But, and just to tie in a couple more, sorry to keep nerding out about the filmmaking of it, but this is one of this movie effectively used a precursor to green screen technology. Because there are some scenes where, like at one point, I think it's, is it maybe Geddes is like looking down over Kane's speech, like he's up in a box and they're looking down over the speech.
Yeah.
In the scene that was shot, the actor in the box is just looking at a blank wall or off into the void. And they like legitimately just cut the film
from the
bigger shot to put the two together. So,
yeah.
And I think that probably helps it make it look pretty seamless. This technology is used a few other times. I was like looking pretty hard for it. So there are some shots where like you see an open window behind the character and like the sun and the sea or something. And it looks pretty good, especially compared to, like, you think about, well, we're almost 100 years later and we still have some pretty shonky green screen moments. So, and it's cool to see stuff like that. And then also another just structural thing that they kind of pioneered here. They didn't invent the montage, but this is like the first time it was implemented on such a scale in such a movie. But the scene where Kane and his first wife, Emily, are having breakfast.
Yeah.
And we just continue to see them have breakfasts, and we see their marriage deteriorate without having to go through all of the, you know, dialogue and all the events in the process. We just kind of see them fall out via this chronological at the time, but non like standard time frame of a shot. Yeah. I think that was like, it's just part of the things that I've been taking away from this classic movie thread is it's so cool to see the genesis of tropes, because there's stuff that we just take for granted now that at the time, like, yeah, someone had to invent it, and it's cool to see where the start was.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about that later in this episode for a different movie. Wink, wink. But yeah, no, I also noticed some of the interesting effects stuff, because I'm pretty sure when he's talking to old Jed, you know, and they're doing the cross dissolve, like the background of Jed's shot goes away, but he's just him in frame is like still dissolving. Honestly, because the background was white, so it looks like it's going faster, or if they cut him out and comped him and like cross dissolved it. But like, yeah, you can. Yeah, they were doing really creative stuff, and it mostly works. The one thing that scared me that I don't know if it was a comp or not, was then we cut, and there's that this fucking like parakeet,
or
whatever, and it's bird. Like, right, and it's so loud. I was like, Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, that was a bit of a jump scare. I was also not prepared for it.
But this is a really cool movie. I'm sure there are so many movies that are inspired by this, like structurally and everything. I can't think of any off the top of my head right now, but
I would have just suggested you already mentioned it, but The Irishman is kind of feels similar. Just because it's like the full portrait of a life of a man and his interactions with the people and places in his life. I would lean towards Citizen Kane, though, for sure, of the two. Yeah.
Shorter for sure.
Yeah. Half the length, if even.
Yeah. That's our review of Citizen Kane. Check it out. It's definitely worth watching, I think, in 2024. But before we end, Perk, we got a lot of bonus reviews to get through. Do you want to start with the stuff we saw together, or do you want to start with your own stuff?
Maybe we'll do the stuff we saw, the stuff we both saw towards the end.
Okay. You go first then. What's something you want to talk about?
So in my pursuit of checking out all the Oscar boxes, I watched just kind of the last few stragglers that I'd yet to see to knock off some of the major categories. So the first movie I watched for that was The Color Purple, which is the musical. So it's a movie that is based on the musical stage play that is based on the book, and maybe also based on the 1980s movie. I don't know what kind of relationships the stage play or the stage musical and the Spielberg movie have in common, but I do know that this is a film adaptation that's also a musical. It follows the life of a woman in the South who goes through some incredible trauma and, you know, her resilience and her development as a person. And it's good. It's kind of weird tonally. There are some absolute whiplash moments where we will go from dancing around in a field, singing a musical number with background dancers and everything, to a scene of like not especially graphic, but sexual assault is a part of the movie, a major part. And so, yeah, tonally, it's kind of all over the place. I'm known to not be a musical fan, but the music in it is good. The singing is really good. The performances are great. They cast Fantasia Barrino, who I remember from American Idol a long time ago, but she played the lead in the stage musical. So that there's a tie over there, and she's fantastic in her role. I could have easily seen a nomination for her. Taraji P. Henson plays Suge Avery, like a blues singer. She's also terrific and worthy of praise. And then the only nomination that this movie ended up getting was for Danielle Brooks as a supporting actress. And she is tremendous. She is, I think, by far and away the standout from this movie for me. Her performance has so much depth of, like, well, so much range. She has to do so much in a small amount of screen time and be believable, and she absolutely kills it. This movie also has Coleman Domingo in the role of Mister, who is the abusive husband of the main character, and he's really good at being evil, and it's a fantastic performance. I'll talk about another performance of his later, but yeah, overall, it felt long too, because musicals do that for me. I always feel like it's like, can we continue? But it's actually like half an hour shorter than the 80s movie. So if you're looking for a non-musical version to tighten it up, not quite. So, and yeah, having not seen the original or the musical, this is my only reference. It's a tough story, but it's pretty well done, I'd say.
Nice. I'm glad to hear it. Give me one more and then I'll hop in.
Okay. We'll continue on with another Coleman Domingo performance. I watched Rustin. Rustin is the story of Bayard Rustin, who was a civil rights leader and a black gay man who was around during and essentially he planned the march on Washington, where 250,000 people marched on Washington for civil rights. He planned it in everything but name, and essentially had to be kind of erased off of the pedestal because he was gay. And it's his story, and it's how, you know, the leaders of the black movement, even though they're on their way to push for civil rights, don't want to be associated with him as a gay man. And it follows some of his relationships, and and it culminates in the march for equality, jobs, it's, I don't know, it's fine. Coleman Domingo is really good, it's a nice form of representation, because I believe he's a queer black man, so it's probably a very important role to him personally, and it's a story I didn't know, and I always like learning about things I didn't know. And it makes sense why this one would have kind of been brushed under the rug at the time. The performance is great. It is. I'm not going to be upset that he was nominated for Best Actor for it.
Mm-hmm.
The movie as a whole is very standard biopic. It's got all the trappings, you know, nothing wowed me about the movie or the structure of the movie or anything like that. But the performance is good. That's for sure. So I think it got recognized for the thing that it could get recognized for, and that's fine. But in a Oscar world where biopics come around so often, it's tough to get super excited. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever get out of this biopic hole we're in? Or as long as they can get nominated, they're just gonna keep getting
as long made. As they continue to get success from an awards standpoint, they're going to keep happening. I don't know. I'm never enthused, but most of them are fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I got you. All right. Well, I'll take the mic here for a second, talk about The Taste of Things. which was France's nomination for international best feature for the Oscars, did not actually get nominated, if I remember right.
Correct.
Not selected, but so this is a movie that I don't know. I was interested in just because I'd heard good things about it and like food porn. I'm like, I love some good food porn. so let's do it. So this takes place. I'm not sure the year. I don't know if they actually ever actually say it, but it's an older, you know, period piece set in France. And it's this couple that's like not officially a couple until later. But both gourmet chefs, and they work at this kind of estate, and the man, I think, runs the estate. I don't remember if he like comes from nobility or not, but, you know, they're gourmet chefs and they're doing what they want to do, which is just cook really good food. And, it's kind of a love story between them, as well as just kind of an exploration of passion, I guess, and kind of passion for your work and for people. And it was good. Like, it was solid. I'm not like screaming for the rooftops about it, but like it was a good time there. It is very like heavy focus on the food. Like there are 10 to 15 minute sections. There's nobody talking. It's just cooking. And I don't know if this is a major critique, but wherever they're putting the mics, man, there's a lot of heavy breathing. Like it's a lot of breathing sounds and like heavy breathing while they're doing the cooking, which is, you know, whatever. But the food looked great. I mean, I'm not a period piece guy, but even back then they're doing what's it called? Baked Alaska. I'm like, I need some of that right now. Looks so good. But yeah, just like really, really good food porn. So if you like that, you know, it's a good feast there. And the story is solid. I mean, it's like I said, nice exploration of passion between this couple and their love for each other and love for food. And I think, you know, it ends in a good way. And a lot of it too is the guy who runs the estate, it's him and like his bros. He's got like a doctor friend and, you know, a guy who runs like a ranch, and they're just like bros. They're eating good food, you know, like they're just both, you know, boys support boys. Let's, you know, go to the ranch and eat some bull testicles, you know? it was a good time. Like I'm kind of all over the place. Cause I don't know, like I enjoyed it, but I'm not like recommending it to anyone. Sure. Like, I don't know. If you're interested, go watch it. Like if you like food, it's a good time. So yeah, that was a taste of things. I had a fine time watching it.
Nice.
Burke, back to you.
Okay. Continuing on that trend of knocking off some Oscar boxes, I watched May December. Which is a movie that I was not excited to watch at all because of the subject matter. Basically, the premise is that Natalie Portman is a television actress who is going to be playing Julianne Moore's character in a movie, and Julianne Moore plays a woman who, when she was 36, had an affair with a 13-year-old boy, and got pregnant, had their first child in jail, and then when she got out, they ended up getting married and having two more kids. It's an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And which is why it's such an interesting movie. You've got some people who are reading it as just a strict drama. And then you've also got some people who are saying it's one of the funniest movies they've seen in a long time.
Oh, interesting. I haven't heard that.
Yeah. And there was a lot of ruckus around when it was nominated for Best Musical or Comedy at the Golden Globes.
Interesting.
And everyone's like, this is not a comedy. It's about, you know, the subject matter that it's about. And while I agree that the subject matter is not usually conducive to that, it does lend itself to a lot of humor.
Interesting.
And like structurally, there's just some, there were some legitimate moments where I would like, oh my God, that mm-hmm. what? And I think it's important. I've even like, it's just such an interesting movie to think about and read about. So I've consumed some, tertiary or secondary content about it. And, someone had pointed out that while there is, you can say that there shouldn't be humor about this movie, the humor, the character who was the victim in this situation is very protected from anything like that. Most of the fun poking is done at the expense of Julianne Moore's character and Natalie Portman's character, who both are predatory in their own ways. But the one moment of humor that everyone points to is like, which stood out the most for me, is the implementation of the score. Because I can't remember off the top of my head, but the score is lifted from an older movie and it's super dramatic soap opera-y type score. And it's just implemented at the weirdest moments. Like just all of a sudden out of nowhere, just huge dramatic score when Julianne Moore opens the refrigerator and is like, I don't know if we have enough hot dogs. Or the score is just, it's like the same score cue too every time, like the same little few bars of score. And then we see that Julianne Moore is like beyond dramatically bawling her eyes out on the bed about how a woman canceled her order for a baked good. And it's like, it's just goofy. The same thing happens. Like Natalie Portman goes to the pet store where they both worked when they hooked up, and she's like trying to get into character in like the storeroom, and it's just goofy to look at. And the score almost like tees you up. Like this is supposed to be stupid. Like this is supposed to be funny.
Yeah. What do you think the director's intention was with the movie? Were they trying to make it a comedy or like, what are they going for?
It's more like, it's hard to say. That's one of the reasons that I enjoyed it, is like, I think it's supposed to, it's like a satire of melodrama is kind of what it is. Like the super ultra dramatic, very one note, good, bad, you know, all that heavy nonsense, crying, all that. I think it's a critique almost. It kind of feels like, because while it does cover tough subject matter, it also pokes fun at the emotionality of everything. Mm-hmm. And like one of the other just hilarious scenes is so Natalie Portman this whole time is trying to get into character to play Julianne Moore. And there's even a scene where Natalie Portman is reading out almost, it looks like to a mirror, maybe just looking at the camera in a dark room, reading out a love letter that Julianne Moore sent to the child at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just a stunning performance from Natalie Portman, who we all know is terrific. And for me, it's a snub that she wasn't nominated. But then we get to the end of the movie and we get to see the movie ends with a shot of filming the movie that Natalie Portman is starring in. And it's just a goofy, awful scene. And her acting is terrible. And to play the boy, they cast like the classic, like a 25-year-old to play a 13-year-old. Yeah. And the idea of this whole, the premise of this movie is that Natalie Portman wants to get it right, wants to do justice to the story, because it had been a shitty TV movie in the past. And it's like, nah, we're going to do it right this time. And we finally get to the filming of it, and it's just the stupidest scene. And it's just bad acting. And it's like, oh, so, it, you know, she was just full of it. Mm. Yeah. So it's a hard movie. That's the thing is like, I can see the people who are really mad about it. And I think that can be valid. I can also see where people think it's hilarious, just not in a traditional sense. Like it's a challenging movie for sure. Gotcha. But I thought it was really good. Especially the acting, the three central performances are terrific. Julianne Moore should have a best supporting nomination. Natalie Portman should have a best lead female actor nomination. But the key one is like Charles Melton as he's Joe. Mm-hmm. He's 36 during when the events of the movie takes place. He's probably the best supporting actor of the year. Yeah. Wasn't even nominated. Yeah. So, I think if nothing else, as an acting showcase, it's terrific. But if you pick at it and unpack it a little bit, it's just there's a lot to look for, a lot to dig into. So, I'm glad I finally watched it.
Yeah.
I'm glad it wasn't as one note as I was assuming it was going to be. So
yeah. Awesome. Let's do one that we both watch, and then we'll go back to you, and then we'll end us up with the big boy. Me and you got to go see Perfect Days, which is Japan's submission for International Best Feature, which did get selected. This movie about a janitor in Japan who he goes around cleaning all the public restrooms in Tokyo. And that's what he does. That's his job. It's his life. And this movie is a very much just a slice of life of, you know, his day to day and his routine and, you know, the people he comes into contact with, you know, here and there, and family at one point. And it's really all there is to it. He goes about and listens to his favorite music as he drives in between, you know, each part of the job. And I really, really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was one of those beautiful movies I've ever seen. Just absolutely gorgeous cinematography. You could tell that the filmmakers just love Tokyo. I really wanted to showcase it. Also, side note, Tokyo has some of the coolest public restrooms I've ever seen in my entire life. What are we doing, Perk? What are we doing in this country? Figure it out.
Have you seen the public restrooms, like, at parks?
They're horrible.
They're terrible. They're horror scenes, for sure.
Yeah. Part of me thinks that somebody just loved those so much. It's like, I want to make a movie where somebody has to go to these bathrooms. Would it be a janitor, you know? But I love this main character. I love he has his routine down, man. He has everything in the right place. He has every day of the week. He does his thing on Sundays. He does his laundry and gets his photos developed. And he's kind of got his life figured out. And then there are little people that come into play that maybe disrupt a little bit, but then he kind of gets back to, you know, what he wants to do. And to me, like, this movie was about just like finding the meaning in the mundane and finding the joy, even when you're doing something that most people look down upon, like cleaning toilets. But it just struck me that every day he walks outside, he looks up at the sky and he smiles, like he's just happy to be alive. And it's, I don't know, it was a very just kind of life affirming film, a bit long, but overall, I really loved it.
Yeah. So, we saw this together and I'm total agreement. It's just beyond beautiful. I also thought my real only critique on the film was that it's just a little long.
Yeah.
It's over 2 hours, and the structure of the film is it's not plot based, really. It's just following this man through his daily routine, and seeing what kind of comes his way. And I don't know. I'm no filmmaker, so maybe not. But I would say we kind of go through the first 3 days in a row, and everything is fairly routine. I think you could maybe cut one of those days,
yeah,
and just take the runtime in a little bit, and still establish that fact that's the routine of it. But I mean, aside from that, it's just so gorgeously shot. It's a guy who cleans bathrooms, and it's just so lovely to look at, mm-hmm. and just the beauty in it, and the small moments, like when he has to, you know, when someone needs to use the restroom, he has to stand outside and he just looks up at the trees and the sunlight coming through.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had heard, maybe we missed it, but at the end, maybe after the credits, the word is given, Komurabi, I think. Which is the Japanese word for the sunlight peeking through the leaves of a tree, essentially. Mm. Because Japan has just words for everything, yeah. And it's lovely. And yeah, it's such a beautiful, like, concept that's used so much throughout the film, and it's just really nice. I believe that Koji Yakusho, I think that's how you say it, he plays the central character. He has like two lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
And even still, he's just so mesmerizing.
He's so good.
Yeah, it's pretty much all facial expression and just him, mm-hmm. reacting to his surroundings. And he just does such a good job of it. And I don't really know what the final scene is trying to say, but the way that he acts it, it's just him, you know, borderlining and tipping one way and another between,
yeah,
crying and laughing. And it's, mm-hmm. It's just such a good performance. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. It's all facial expression and his body language too. Like, I'm thinking back on, there's a scene where he's trying not to wake somebody up. Upstairs, oh, yeah. So he's trying to like sneak around his apartment. And Yeah, I wasn't sure going in if I was going to cry in this movie, but there's a hug that got me. And I was like, God damn it. But yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, this is a great, I think this might be good on a rewatch too, now that I know the structure more. And like,
yeah,
I was kind of waiting for something to happen for a while. Sure. Like, okay. And that's when it's too long. But
The trailer to it, it kind of seems like that there's like an inciting event in the trailer almost.
Right.
Yeah. But that event doesn't even come till like an hour and 15 minutes in. And it's not even really like the start of action. It's more just a moment.
Yeah. It doesn't last as long as you think it's going to last.
No.
But
that's okay. It works really well for what it is. And yeah, for a movie about a guy who cleans toilets. I immediately went home and cleaned my whole apartment after watching
it. Gotcha,
clearly it's effective.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect Days. Definitely recommend it. Go check it out. All right, Perk, back to you. And then we're doing the big boy.
All right. So I got one more Oscar nod that I checked out. And it was nominated for cinematography. El Conde is what it's called.
Mm.
And it's a bananas premise. Okay. So
I'm buckled up.
Yeah. The idea is that we're introduced via a narrator speaking in English to this character, Auguste Panoche, I believe, who was like a real figure from history, who was the dictator of Chile at one point. And essentially what we come to learn is that he is a vampire who is 250 years old. We get introduced to him as, you know, a young man in France is where he gets his start and is, you know, in the French military and using his powers to kind of ascend the ranks. He's there for the overthrow. He actually steals Marie Antoinette's head because he likes the taste of her blood. And we follow him on his ascendancy and the way he kind of uses his power to kind of effectively move through politics is the way that it's applied and use that politics to do shady deals to make himself a fortune. It kind of is like the pursuit of wealth is his main deal. And we catch up to him when he's 250, he's an old man, living in it. He's since been tossed off his throne in Chile, has been ostracized. Is exercise even a word? Sorry. Been ostracized. And he has a wife and he has five children and they all come back. And essentially he says like, yeah, I want to die. I'm sick of this. I'm trying to be dead. And so he's been starving himself of blood, but for some reason can't die. And one of the siblings, this is a Spanish language film other than the English narrator, by the way. One of the siblings brings in a nun who's going to try and cleanse him or something, I guess.
Are his kids also vampires?
No. So his kids and his wife aren't vampires, but his butler is a vampire.
Okay.
His butler was a Russian Orthodox military man who trained thousands of torturers. That's the butler.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
But his family knows he's a vampire?
Yes, they know.
Okay.
And so this nun comes in and he falls for her and is like, I want to live again. So he goes out and starts, you know, hunting people and eating their hearts. And, the nun is, the kids all come because they want his money. I'm just going to explain this essentially because you're not going to watch it. No one's going to watch it. The kids all come back because when he dies, they want their inheritance. And the nun comes in posing as an accountant trying to sort through their papers and everything. But her ulterior motive is she wants to steal all that money to pay, you know, the bills at her church, essentially. And I think in the process of doing that, she sacrifices herself and, you know, gets in line with the vampire guy and gets turned into a vampire herself. Sorry, but it gets even weirder because once the The young nun gets turned into a vampire. The old wife is jealous, so she has the butler turn her into a vampire. And so now there are a bunch of vampires running around.
Okay.
Yep. And the bunch of vampires running around has caused a ruckus in the what we didn't know was an existent vampire community. So our narrator, turns out, has been Margaret Thatcher the whole time. Yes, okay. The former Prime Minister of England. So she
was a vampire?
She was a vampire. Okay. So she flies down and, like, essentially, like, they end up killing the nun, killing the wife, and killing the butler. And then the main character vampire, who it turns out is Margaret Thatcher's son, and Margaret Thatcher fly off into the sunset. They eat vampire hearts, which de-ages them. And so he's like a kid again, and she's like his mom.
Are we sure this isn't the What We Do in the Shadows spinoff?
It kind of feels like it feels like the way it's shot, too, because it's nominated for cinematography. It's gorgeous to look at. Honestly, yeah. I wouldn't be half mad if it won. It won't, obviously, but it kind of feels like, what if Wes Anderson and Yorgos Lanthimos collaborated?
Oh, okay. Because
some of the shots feel a little bit Anderson, not to his full level.
Not full Anderson. You never go full Anderson.
Right. But you never go full Anderson. But it's just so bananas and bonkers. And it's like too long and kind of messy. But like, I love that movies like this can exist. I love that someone made this. It's a Netflix film. So if anyone's actually curious after hearing my full plot synopsis.
Is it a comedy?
Yeah, it's a dark comedy for sure.
Okay. I mean, it does kind of sound like What We Do in the Shadows a little bit.
It does. It has a little bit of the kind of comedy vampire vibe.
Yeah.
But it's also super gory in sections. Yeah. I don't know, man. Whoever thought of this, kudos. Like, the movie rests way more on the premise than it does on, like, actual story structure or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good premise, so it works well enough. The highlight is the cinematography. It's black and white, and it's gorgeous to look at. So, a deserved nomination.
There you go. El Conde, check it out. Maybe.
Or don't. I told you what goes on. That's probably enough.
Yeah. All right, Perk. Let's finish it out with the biggest movie right now in the world. It seems like everyone's, I feel like nobody was talking about it. Now everybody's talking about it. Dune Part 2. So really briefly, I rewatched the first one before seeing Dune 2 in the same day. And I'm just going to say this, get this away first. I'm in a weird spot with these movies because I've read the book and I like the book. And then this is a good adaptation. So it's like, therefore, these are good then. It's like how I feel watching like Demon Slayer now, where like I've read the manga and I like the manga and they adapt it. And it's the same story. So therefore, it's good. But it's like I'm not like directly liking the movies or the show. I'm like the source material and then it's like a version of it. It's kind of a weird relationship. But that being said, I like Dune a lot. I'm not like the biggest Dune fan. I'm not screaming from the rooftops or anything, but I like it. But anyway, saw Dune 2 and Perk, nobody does sci-fi visuals like Denis. Like, are we fucking kidding with like this is absolutely insanely cool looking and gorgeous movie. Like and the sound, like to me, and this might be hyperbolic, maybe not. What Star Wars was for like sci-fi visuals, you know, back then, this might be like the new Star Wars, like of this is what sci-fi can and like, probably should look like. So I had a really good time with Dune 2.
Yeah. So I had the same thought when I was watching it. I was like, this makes me feel like what Star Wars used to back when I was still excited about it. It's fun to see like, first of all, Denis Villeneuve is a outstanding filmmaker. I love all of his films. But to see like an IP that hasn't been choked to death yet and is in the sci-fi realm, it's just very cool. And yeah, the visuals and the sound and everything works so well together. some of those, like, I had goosebumps looking at some of those scenes of on like the Harkonnen homeworld.
Yeah. Oh my god.
The black sun planet. It's just,
yeah.
And I was like trying to do the math. Like, if the sun was black, would actually there be no color? Yeah, actually, I think maybe. and nerding out a little bit, but just, it's just so stunning. I liked it a lot. I think I went and saw it with someone who had some gripes on some things that have changed from the book to the movies. And the one thing I've thought, because I also read the book, between the book and the movie, there have been some things where I was like, okay, but how are they going to do this? Like, this would just be so hard to put to film. And a lot of times the answer is, well, they don't.
They just don't do it. Yeah.
And then I see that and I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, we actually kind of could go without that. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, there's other things that have changed a little bit. And the one thing that the person I saw it with was, kind of most confused by was Chani's path, which
yeah,
I'm not gonna,
is a bit different.
Yeah, I'm not spoiling it, but essentially it's to me, it's like what happens if you look at Chani from the book and actually give her a character.
Exactly. I think she works so well in the movies, and like her interplay with Paul is way more interesting. And so I think it was for the best.
Yeah. But overall, I loved it. I really like the source material. I love the movies. And part of that's just because I really just love the way Denis Villeneuve makes films. But on top of all that, it's really well put together. You have to watch the first one. The second one picks up like
immediately
5 minutes later.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. You definitely have to watch the first one. And if this doesn't win for production design, like, what are we doing? Like, this is like one of the most well thought out productions I've ever seen. It just, everything looks perfect and the visual effects are gorgeous. Like, how is it? Like, I didn't question an effect one time in this movie. Like, everything just looks so seamless and like beautiful, and like how they intercut like visions and all this stuff. Like, everything's very like clear when they want it to be clear, and but fuzzy when they want it to be fuzzy. And then like the acting's insane. Like, Javier Bardem as Stilgar, the fucking homie, man. I loved him so much.
He's such a simp.
We got to laugh in this movie as well. Like, the first one, there was no laughing. There was actually, like, funny stuff in this one. It felt way more, I was telling Joseph, I saw it with my roommate, we're back. I'm like, this movie just feels more alive than the first movie, because there's just more range of emotions and characters. The first one's a lot of exposition. It's a lot of setup. It's a lot of tragedy. I mean, it's pretty much, like, setup and then pain. You know, this one, there's more going on and just more characters and stuff. Austin Butler, you know, all the acting of that was just insane. I will say, I'm gonna give a little bit, a small knock to the man, the myth, legend, Christopher Walken, because his accent comes out a little bit at times and makes me laugh. It's like I hear him deliver some lines like, you're Christopher Walken. What are we doing?
It's a weird pick. It could have just been anyone. It didn't have to be Christopher Walken. I understand that the cast is just absolutely star studded, but surely you can come up with like Anthony Hopkins or something. I don't know. Yeah,
or Michael Caine, you know, like
someone who just isn't so distinct for his voice. Like,
and his
look. There's just no other Christopher Walken. So it's hard to look past that. I think Florence Pugh is great as his daughter.
Yeah. Not a ton to do in this one, but if we hopefully get a third one, she'll have way more to do, as far as I understand, which I think we might. Like, this movie's tracking really well box office wise. So,
I think we could get another one. I heard today that there will be a third, and I think that that's going to be the last one that Villeneuve does.
I think that'd be okay.
I kind of hope so, because I know that there's, you know, a lot of novels in this series, and I know they go in kind of super funky paths. And I mean, we can already see the way this one's going, but there's no bow on it at the end, so it's definitely open for it, and Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if the first two are precedent, I'm sure we can expect the third to be really good.
Yeah, great stuff. And you mentioned right at the top, like, it's nice to see something that hasn't been, like, fully strangled for content yet. It might happen still, and I hope it doesn't.
I'm sure we'll get all the, if it keeps making money, we'll get it.
Yeah, but, I hinted earlier when Howard Citizen Kane, it's like, Dune, you know, was written before so much sci-fi was created, and you can tell it's inspiration for a lot of different stuff, like Star Wars and I saw a TikTok talking about how like Warhammer seems very inspired by Dune, like the lore from Warhammer. Mm-hmm. But it's cool to see that like really old, you know, story then brought to a modern lens and people could experience it now in like a easily accessible way, in a way that's just like absolutely gorgeous and stunning. So, yeah, go see Dune Part 2. I don't think there's anybody would not recommend it to.
No, like on the biggest screen you can.
Yeah, with the best speakers possible.
And make sure to run to the restroom beforehand.
Honestly, it didn't feel... Well, I felt a little bit long. I was getting scared. I'm like, are we going to be able to see the climax? Or are they going to, you know, stop it early? But no.
That honestly, me too. Because I like thinking back to the book, I'm like,
yeah,
we still have a scene we got to do, guys. Like,
yeah,
it's already been 2.5 hours. But I had 2 cups of coffee before I went in. So I was doomed. I did make it, but I pretty much sprinted out of there.
At the end, you're struggling. Oh, man. All right. Well, that is our episode for this week. Thank you everyone for watching. Be on the lookout for a bonus episode. It's probably already out of our Oscar predictions. Oscars are coming up real quick. So we're going to go through all those and predict what I think will happen there. So look out for that. But for the normal programming, next week, we're going to be following Orson Welles to The Third Man. Perkins is one of your picks. I don't know anything about it. So I'm excited to see you. What it is about and how good it is. But that is streaming on Criterion if you have that, or Tubi if you want to watch it free with ads. Otherwise, you have to rent it. So The Third Man for next week. But until then, thanks for watching. Bye.
Bye-bye.